So it's wonderful now to have Dr. Kate Bowler with us this morning, and I'm assuming all of you did your homework assignment, which was to read her New York Times piece. I will not give you a test, but as you know, she's an assistant professor of history of Christianity at Duke Divinity School, and she did her doctorate on the top a subject of which became this book published by Oxford University Press called Blessed, A History of the American Prosperity Gospel. I warmly recommend it to you. Some of you might be wondering, why are we doing the subject of the prosperity gospel? Well, simply because, as you heard yesterday, one of the most important theological advisors to President Trump is a woman named Paula White from a huge mega church, prosperity gospel church in Orlando. And so we thought it would be important for you all, for all of us, to know something more about the prosperity gospel. And we're privileged to have the leading expert on prosperity gospel in the country, if not the world. So, Kate, it's wonderful to have you. Thank you for coming.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and thanks so much to Michael and the Faith Angle Forum. These are not just wonderful minds, but wonderful people. I'm so grateful to be here. So when I first wrote Blessed, I thought that my job primarily was to explain why one of the most derided Christian movements in American history was not just a punchline. I wanted them to be taken seriously, as we historians like to say, despite its reputation for being maudlin and smarmy. To be sure, I understood people's deep antipathy toward its preachers and its theology. I once saw a prosperity preacher, the late Jan Crouch of TBN fame, transform this lovely little theme park in Orlando in her own image by bedazzling it with a fleet of golden lions and cardboard cutouts of her face. But I was deeply sympathetic, and I am deeply sympathetic, if not a little defensive, of the movement and its ability to keep its finger on the pulse of people's deepest desires. The movement seemed to understand something profound about the American religious imagination that the wider culture was too quick to dismiss. For all the riches gained from their bestsellers and their 24-hour Christian programming and their packed megachurches, the prosperity movement has always coveted what it did not have. So politicians might court its churches, but then not publicize its preachers' endorsements. City leaders wanted their cooperation, but not always their place on boards and councils. Universities did not clamor to give their preachers an honorary PhD. And when a stately figure died, no one really wanted to host a funeral in their sanctuaries. At best, prosperity preachers smelled like new money. And there was nothing terribly respectable about the movement's public image. No one championed their causes in the halls of power until now. Donald Trump is the first American president whose only religious impulses arise from the American prosperity gospel. It is well known that the Trump family attended Marble Collegiate Church in New York City, a venerable Reformed Church in America pulpit, whose entrepreneurial pastor, Norman Vincent Peale, preached a theology which also became his personal brand. Peale's runaway bestseller, The Power of Positive Thinking, was a sunny mix of new thought mind power, which we'll talk a little bit about in a minute, combined with a high anthropology, which is to say a high view of the capacity of human nature. That was a fixture of mainline Protestantism. The result was a simple recipe for successful living. Quote, as you think, so shall you be. Or in other words, quote, think positively and you set in motion positive forces which bring positive results to pass, unquote. So what this does is it casts the vision of a mind as a powerful spiritual incubator, something that could achieve health and wealth and all-round happiness, a high-flying optimism that seems to have shaped Trump's youthful outlook. When he was married for the first time, it was Reverend Peale who performed the wedding ceremony in the sacred birthplace of positive thinking. But there are two other strands woven into Trump's sparse religious biography. The businessman who relentlessly promoted himself as a self-made man found spiritual solace in a young televangelist from Florida named Paula White, who, as it so many of you have interviewed. I'm thrilled to know. Her perky twist on the Pentecostal prosperity gospel led to books with titles like Deal With It! And her own workout videos, which I highly recommend. She was the sexy embodiment of the supernatural bootstrapping of prosperity theology, a self-proclaimed messed-up Mississippi girl whose life, once marred by abuse and neglect, was reborn to success by living according to the divine laws of faith. Of the scores of prosperity preachers in the public eye, White was famous as the queen of second chances, as she had remade her own ministry several times after living many lives. First, as the former protege of African-American superstar T.D. Jakes, then as a one-time televangelist, now online personality, and also as the pastor of a megachurch, Without Walls International Church, whose fortunes rose and fell with her. And if you're interested, we can talk a bit more about her time being married and divorced and being one of the only women who's ever successfully run a megachurch post-divorce. Along with the virtually unknown prosperity pastor named Mark Burns, White became a cheerful stumper for Trump on the campaign trail and joined Texas televangelists Gloria and Kenneth Copeland on his religious board of advisors. So for the first time in American history, a president instinctively turned toward prosperity thinkers to shape his religious views about what might make America great again. As Trump's connections to positive thinking and the Pentecostal prosperity gospel are combined with his blatant American exceptionalism, we can see that the three strands of what constitutes, historically, the prosperity gospel have been woven together. Trump is, in short, the prosperity gospel's religious trifecta. Since understanding the nature of the prosperity gospel has never meant more politically, I would like to propose three things to keep in mind in what promises to be a long slog in reporting about it. So the first thing I'd like to talk about is the scale of the movement. The second is about the coherence of the message. And the last is about the Americanness of the gospel and what it says about this country's tolerance for inequality. So let's talk a little bit about the scale. The prosperity gospel is vastly more widespread than people typically imagine that it is. It's preached in many of the largest churches on every continent. So the largest church on the planet, I'm sure many of you know, is the Yoido Full Gospel Church in Seoul, South Korea. It claims 1 million members, and they're now, unfortunately, criminally convicted pastor David Youngie Cho. What's lesser known is that in the 70s and 80s, he used to tour the states with other up-and-coming prosperity pastors, him as the grand authority of how to grow churches in America. Many of the...
He
was convicted of embezzlement, something like $12 million, or his... I didn't follow the details, but the family kind of went down hard. So a lot of the biggest churches in every African nation are famous for their prosperity preaching. Nigeria's largest church, the Redeemed Nigerian Church of God, is also a denomination with megachurches that span the globe. If anyone is interested, I think it's an amazing story of how a professional class of Nigerians came to the States and Canada and rapidly built a whole network of churches and have these mammoth annual conferences that bring in American politicians as their main speakers. So, I mean, don't imagine then that this is something far away. These are aggressively expansive denominations that are here in many forms. So it's not also just a message of hope for the poor. It's heard in some of the largest churches in first world nations. So one of the largest churches in London, for example, is a prosperity church, Kingsway International Christian Center. And if you look in Singapore, their English dominant professional class is many of them go to one of Singapore's largest church, City Harvest Church. You can see Singaporean pop stars that are also prosperity princesses that inherit enormous prosperity kingdoms. So these are just a vast global enterprise, if you have eyes to see. It's also found in kind of unusual forms. There is a lay Catholic movement in the Philippines called the El Shaddai movement that is largely a Catholic prosperity gospel with direct ties to American prosperity preachers. It has upwards of 10 million participants, according to some counts. So it's unusual forms, also in some more predictable forms. Pastors with capitalistic names, like Creflo Dollar or Frederick Price or Guatemala's favorite, Cash Luna. Cash Luna. It's also a fun way to talk to people on the airplane if you hate what they are already talking about. So who's your favorite local prosperity pastor? Every country has one. It is present in a lot of mega churches and also in small churches alike. A lot of the most famous Christian music albums come out of prosperity mega churches, both in the States, but most famously in Australia's largest church, Hillsong. So it blankets television networks, TBN, CBN, Daystar, as some of the most watched religious programs in the world. So it has many different forms, many different preachers, but it has a consistent message: God wants to bless you. So people usually say televangelist as a kind of shorthand, and what I would love to tell you all about someday, the history of why people think that, but just remember it's one of many hubs, sort of saturation points of where this message resides. So I calculated that among the about 1,650 megachurches today, among those megachurches, I calculated that roughly 40% of churches over 10,000 preach a prosperity message. So the prosperity gospel holds a significant share of Protestant churches with the largest market reach. So highest number of Twitter followers and social media saturation and television and internet streaming viewers and conference attendees. In my new book, The Preacher's Wife, Women in Power in American Mega Ministry, which I am submitting next week, praise be, I had to invent this term mega ministry to try to describe this phenomenon that I first encountered in the prosperity gospel. The heights of spiritual superstardom in America, what I call mega ministry, is a tangled series of networks of the largest churches, denominations, parachurch organizations, Christian publishing companies, music producers, and television networks. Size is the most dominant feature of modern ministry. There are more large churches now than ever before. Christian television programming is now measured by its potential broadcast audiences by the billions. Secular media conglomerates own and acquire evangelical imprints in order to launch their own Christian nonfiction onto the bestseller list. So size becomes one of the most important angles of vision, I think, into understanding how influence circulates religiously. So for my women's book, I found that one of the most interesting consequences of big church life is the commercialization of the entire pastor's family. So in the women book, the 120 or so interviews I did with pastors' wives from across theological traditions, I saw how wives then became commodified, became celebrities in their own right, with a niche market all her own.
Who's the publisher?
That's Princeton. Princeton will publish it in the... It'll be in the fall of, what's the next year? 2018, that one, that's what it is. So all that to say, when the prosperity gospel mastered big with their natural language of fundraising and growth, they achieved a national presence and a market dominance that was often disproportionate to their actual numbers. They dominated the top churches, and so they dominated the aisles of the inspirational section at Barnes & Noble. It's a game I like to play with my in-laws when we go to Walmart, is what is not a prosperity preacher? And usually there's just one title, and everything else is Joel Osteen's beautiful, beautiful face. Okay, so that's the scope of the movement. So I would like to now address the coherence of the prosperity gospel, and I would like to officially release all of you from the burden of worrying about whether someone calls themselves a prosperity preacher. I absolve you. So let me assure you, it is a completely unwinnable fight. Not even Mike Murdoch, who on late night TV any night will be selling seven keys to seven kingdoms to seven something somethings. Even Mike Murdoch does not consider himself a prosperity preacher. So what I did was I was obsessed with this for over 10 years in order to try to solve this problem primarily so that no one else has to. So you're welcome. In my book, I developed an elaborate series of appendices just so that people could use it as a reference point. So I identified 115 prosperity megachurches at the time of publication. I'm sure there are more.
In U.S.?
These are American, yes. I did track all the Canadian ones, but, you know, Canadian press is super important nowadays. I just always tell them, but no one in the States usually cares. And then I attended all of the major spiritual conferences at least once. I spent a year and a half doing a local ethnography in a storefront African American prosperity church. And I used conference advertisements for the most widely circulated Pentecostal magazine and tracked it over 30 years to see which speakers shared a stage again and again, effectively mapping the associational network and watching how prosperity ideas grew and gained traction. So in total, I tracked 4,267 speakers across 1,636 conferences over three decades. I think it's more compelling to decide whether someone belongs to the movement by looking at their associates and their institutions, but very little of it is as obvious as the pastor's self-identification or even what's on the church sign. So, for example, one of the largest churches in the United Methodist denomination, of which my school is a part, Windsor Village United Methodist Church, there are more prosperity preachers in that church's bookstore than any other church I've been to since Creflo Dollars. So it's very, very little of it is as obvious. That is also a promise to you. If you ever think, is this person a prosperity preacher? Feel free to shoot me an email. I'll put it in my little database, and I will joyfully tell you who they are best friends with. That or the graphs I have in the back of my book. So may I propose instead that when determining whether someone is a prosperity preacher, we look for four theological or ideational themes: faith, health, wealth, and victory. So the prosperity gospel grew out of the Pentecostal healing revivals of the post-war period. After World War II, hundreds of ministers broke with their Pentecostal denominations. They left their homes and picked up their tents and traveled Canada and the United States as healers and preachers and miracle workers. They were playing around with a vocabulary of faith that had been developed much earlier. In the late 19th century, the rise of the metaphysical movement called New Thought had convinced a generation of Americans that their minds were potent incubators of their dreams, a powerful confidence that Christians first applied to health, trying to solve the problem of why some people are healed and some people are not. That's very important when you are a faith healer. And then later, applied it to wealth. So in this view, you just have to remember when you're listening to them talk, faith is not a kind of innocuous word. Faith, I think in regular Sunday school world, synonyms are like hope or trust. But in this world, faith is a spiritual power. It is a force that as if it reaches through the bounds of materiality and into the spiritual realm and is able to draw things back into time and space. It conceives of faith as an activator, a power given to all believers that binds and looses spiritual forces, turning the spoken word into reality. So it's also not fair to say, like, if you just want it enough. It's not true. It has to be activated in your mind and then spoken out loud. So just as God said, let there be light, and so there is light, believers thought that if they speak words, it acts as a spiritual law, guaranteeing that whatever we believe and confess, we possess. So this is the reason why some people call it name it, claim it, et cetera, et cetera. So what you have to hear here is that faith sounds more and more like a tool, an instrumentalizing ability. So you'll hear people say, I have faith for, or I'm believing God for, as if faith propels the desired outcome. But of course, it also describes the coming into being of negative spiritual forces, like poverty or disease, rather than God's abundance if you speak wrongly. So how do you then know that your faith is working? Fundamentally, you look at your body, so health. The prosperity gospel's promise of health followed well-established Christian traditions of healing, but it went a step further, seeing healing as something guaranteed by what Jesus did on the cross. So instead, Jesus' death and resurrection doesn't just take on the penalties of sin, but it breaks the powers of poverty, demonic interference, and sickness. So let's remember that before the Prosperity Gospel was called the Prosperity Gospel, it was a healing revival. So before Oral Roberts magazine was called Abundant Life, it was called Healing Waters. They were healers at heart. God set up the laws of faith so believers could access the power of the cross, wielding their faith as a power. So, and we can talk a bit about more about this later, but that's why I think it's inaccurate when people think of the prosperity gospel as a kind of get-rich-quick movement or a cheap theology. And I mean that even about the preachers. I loved Mark Oppenheimer's GQ piece on Peter Popoff. As kind of, he's the worst of them in many people's views, as the kind of hardest-working man in spiritual business. It was a wonderful, an example of beautiful prosperity reporting. But I think what we need to remember is that the prosperity gospel was costly in many ways to its believers. People worked extremely hard at generating positive expectations about the future, avoiding negative ideas and words about the past and the present, and behaving as if their prayers had already come true, a practice known as acting faith. So they move their bodies as if they're not sick. They thank God for financial payments that haven't yet come. They praise God for wayward kids that have not yet come home. Not yet, they would say, but soon. This is Weber's Protestant work ethic folded entirely into a mental world. Believers scoured their minds of words and emotions and spirits that could inhibit them from seeing their lives confirm their faithfulness. But see, this is always a reciprocal loop. They believed that the healing had already happened until it happened. So they would try to walk and talk and act healed. Their primary task was to apply their faith to their circumstances and then measure their own bodies for evidence of spiritual power. Okay, so that's faith and that's health. Its most controversial claim was its ability to transform invisible faith into financial rewards. So let's remember, it blooms in the economic summer of the post-war years. More and more people began to see all Christians perhaps possessing the God-given potential to sow and reap their own financial harvest. If you care, I'm so happy to describe the ways in which they explain that. So a lot of it comes from John 10:10. From Jesus' lips that he came that they might have life and have it more abundantly. So there's all kinds of arguments, what Jesus does on the cross. The problem is that, honestly, it was a little bit awkward because all sorts of healing theologies are very predicated on Jesus' own body suffering on the cross, and it was easy to kind of create an analog between your own experience and Jesus' own suffering, but it was hard when it came to money to say that there was a moment in the story that they could see that divine exchange take place. There was a lot of, like, people really had to kind of go for it. Leroy Thompson was one of the defenders of the sort of divine exchange of suffering for glory, financial glory. He said, "He took your place in poverty so you could take his place in prosperity." Jesus' resurrection, there's this moment where Jesus says he couldn't stand being broke any longer. He came up on the third day. He said, in effect, enough of this. And so there's not that many that kind of are that specific, but there's a general sense that there's some kind of cosmic exchange going on in Jesus' own suffering. People also looked for little clues. The wise men, you know, they didn't bring toys. They brought gold and incense, and there's thoughts maybe the cloak, that's why the guards fought about the cloak, is that it was really expensive. So there's kind of attempts to do that, but the truth is, it was much easier in the Old Testament to find examples of covenant and promise and abundance, and they used, of course, not all Hebrew scriptures fit that model. Job, I'm so happy to ever talk about Job with anyone who wants to, but it sort of demonstrated a kind of canon within the canon in which they're reinterpreting scripture through this lens. So how is it that financial rewards come into the hands of believers? They differed on the kind of exact nature of how this takes place, and I think it's important to see prosperity preachers along a spectrum. In this case, a very direct relationship between speaking and claiming and then financial reward. We can call, I like to call this hard prosperity. Hard prosperity drew a straight line between life's circumstances and a believer's faith. So it operated as a perfect law, and any irregularities meant that it was the believer who didn't play by the rules. So specificity is very clearly seen in a hard prosperity model when it comes to giving. Participants were instructed to name their pleas, so a house, a car, a raise, out loud very often in prosperity services. Hard prosperity hammered it into a hammered their theology into rules, rigid rules. Pay tithes. This is for this reason why some of them require bank, what's the American one? W-2s when you have to file your. So they'd ask the church. The church would ask believers to submit their W-2s so they could make sure that people were really hitting that 10% mark of tithes, and then in ones in addition for gifts on Pastor's Appreciation Day, church anniversaries. There was any number of times in which that number would be insufficient. Formulas for wealth grew increasingly precise. There's the doctrine of first fruits, first introduced in the 1960s as a standard classification for donation. So that's the first fruits is if you get like a $50 raise every week, then the first $50 has to go to the church. Paula White loves her first fruits. She is a big first fruits girl. So people began not just to donate their money, but to instruct God of what they wanted, a practice Oral Roberts had dubbed naming your seed. He has his The Miracle of Seed Faith book that he publicized. He published in about 1963. It's an ingenious metaphor for the spiritual work that they're doing, right? That they sow the money into the ground, the righteous ground, which is the prosperity preacher. They use all the agricultural metaphors for that incubation time in which they wait, but it hasn't yet come to pass. And then the harvest comes, and when the harvest hasn't come, then you can sing Juanita Bynum's song, I don't mind waiting. I don't mind waiting. She waits a lot in that song, but there's a kind of ritualization of the patience required to wait for God to show up. So people might order checks with Bible verses on them. I saw that a lot. One really clever woman I always sat beside used to write, money cometh unto you, in the memo line, so that when the bank teller would look at it, the teller would say, money cometh unto you, and then positively confess on her behalf, which she really liked. I also just spent a lot of time in parking lots, just taking down vanity license plates, prayed for, blessed, hundredfold. Actually, when I got really, really sick, and I went out to this lovely place on the beach, and I was like having an emotional moment, and I realized I was standing next to a yacht that said, too blessed to be stressed. I was like, ah! So, why? I am haunted. All right, so that's wealth. And let's talk lastly about victory. It took me a long time to kind of figure out exactly what this was. And it's what Callie was talking about a telos. Like, it's an end. It's a horizon that they set, that they think of as victory. It's the sense that within a single human life, all things can be made right, which means that, I mean, for given the really high percentage of African-American churches, that any obstacle, institutional, personal, racial, all things will crumble before a righteous believer. And so you see that a lot in their symbolism, in the love of eagles or globes or in their titles like World Changers, Victory World Church, to the Champion Center that has an actual trophy as a church symbol. Church mottos were also another way to declare victory. The byline of Fred Shipman's multiracial church in West Palm Beach said it all, Winner's Church, where winning is a lifestyle. So it promises total victory over crushing circumstances and guarantees that all people can be true conquerors. So faith, health, wealth, victory. These are all visions of a certain kind of God. This is what I look for when I'm talking to somebody and I'm spending a lot of time at their church. Believers call this feeling, the feeling that God is working things out for you, favor. So if someone ever has like a prayer request and then it comes true, you might just hear people kind of chant it in the crowd. They'll be like, favor! And then it's a kind of a beautiful moment for people. Paula White explained favor as that feeling that, quote, he's on your side, that he's making a way for you. Okay, so let's now turn to the questions of Americanness and talk about its political arc. So I've always argued that the message resonated with a set of national characteristics that are deeply embedded in the social imaginary. At times, the prosperity gospel hovered so close to its nationalistic alter ego, American civil religion, that it looked like its Pentecostal twin, each offering an account of transcendent truths at the core of the American character. So rather than sacralizing the founding of the country or manifest destiny, the prosperity gospel was constituted by the deification and ritualization of the American dream. Upward mobility, accumulation, hard work, moral fiber. The two shared an unshakably high anthropology, studded with traits that inspire action and urgency and a sense of chosenness and a desire to shoulder it alone. So if this is a gauge of the nation's self-perception, then this is surely a country soaring with confidence in the possibility of human transformation. The movement's culture of godmen and conquerors rang true in a nation that embraced a mythology of righteous individuals bending circumstances to their vision of the good life. It didn't just give Americans a gospel worthy of a nation of self-made men, and they were usually men. It affirmed the basic economic structures on which individual enterprise stood. So until this election season, whenever I was asked about politics, I always thought it was entirely plausible that it would always bend away from the political and toward the therapeutic. After all, the two most watched Christian televangelists in the world are Joel Osteen and Joyce Meyer. They're prosperity preachers who built their entire ministerial empires on apolitical topics, such as self-esteem and emotional management. In fact, it was this turn toward therapeutic paradigms that had saved the prosperity gospel from disgrace when, in the late 1980s and early 1990s, hard-sell prosperity preachers like Jim Baker made the movement a laughingstock. Baker's much-publicized sexual and financial misdeeds became synonymous with the image of the slick televangelist, weeping and begging crowds for cold cash. And so the televangelists that took their places adopted a gentler approach. In keeping with the darker postmodern mood of the mid-1990s, they took up issues of psychological transformation, promising to sell audiences tools to improve their self-esteem rather than simply asking for donations. The giants of the 90s, Joyce Meyer, T.D. Jakes, they galvanized audiences with frank talks about difficult subjects like sexual abuse with T.D. Jakes' franchise, Woman, Thou Art Loosed. The message of divine health and wealth was still clear, but the therapeutic ministrations of what I call soft prosperity emphasized the spiritual and material benefits of a renewed mind. The battle was interior, not exterior to the self. In the United States, the prosperity gospel's promise that right-thinking, right-believing Christians could triumph over any obstacle had always made the role of politics rather ambivalent. Its heavily individualistic nature leaned away from structural indictments or solutions because the answer always lay within. So as such, the prosperity gospel could always take the end run around systems to promise that God would always provide a solution to these problems. So I tried really hard to track responses to the recession and the government shutdown in order to ask, you know, do prosperity preachers ever sort of deviate from that message to say, well, maybe we can, maybe the structures, the institutional systems are at fault. And instead, I got the characteristically bland and optimistic, urging people to turn to God and not Washington for results. There were some sort of systematic descriptions. If you ever Google the term end times wealth transfer, it's a lot of fun. But it's a hard prosperity indictment of satanic systems. Very often, Wall Street was a real target, and would say that that believers might be robbed now, but in the end, the righteous would find that their coffers were full and that God had found a way around this corruption, bulldozing a divine path. Now, there are lots of exceptions to this paradigm. Depending on racial and regional demographics, lesser-known megachurch pastors might take a side. African-American prosperity preachers, now there's a huge denominational range there, but if they supported, if they had historic denominational ties, they usually openly supported a presidential candidate, sometimes Democratic, sometimes Republican, and maintained a presence in city politics. I spent a lot of time following Latino prosperity churches, and it really depended actually whether they were, how they were on the spectrum of hard to soft prosperity. The harder prosperity, and very often those in South Florida, were much more politically active, and they were usually committed Republicans with a favorite political candidate who might visit their megachurch now and again. And then, of course, I think the story we know more readily are the holdouts from the 80s, the old religious right warriors, the John Hagees and Rod Parsleys and Kenneth and Gloria Copelands, and they remained the bullhorns of family values espoused by political darlings who came and went. But most national prosperity preachers are not typically seen as those with an axe to grind. Their widespread appeal has been in part owing to their deliberate silence when it comes to an election. So are we seeing the evolution of the prosperity gospel in the era of Trump? Has it gained new political traction? Yes and no. Certainly Donald Trump is an ambivalent hero for any religious movement whose only explicit religious beliefs seem to come from impulses, likely, rather than a fully orbed religious worldview, but you probably know more about that than I do. But his spiritual loyalties seem from the outside to be malleable in this way. His time in Washington seems like it will be more likely steered by religiously by white evangelical political sway and the persistence of the religious rights power brokers than Paula White. But if you give me that megachurch list of all the ones, the megachurch pastors that showed up recently, we just run them through that database and figure out who's who. I don't really know who he's networking with right now, but I think there's an easy map to make associationally to figure it out. As you well know, Trump is an unlikely advocate for hot-button evangelical issues. A three-time married man fighting for traditional families, a sexual braggart at the helm of a purity-obsessed culture. But in many other ways, his individualistic vision of self-made men saddled with righteous causes and a vision of Christian America galvanized voters and offered Trump Washington allies forged in the fires of past evangelical culture wars. So then perhaps he is the most stunning example of the success of the prosperity gospel in casting a vision of the self-made American. The prosperity gospel is fundamentally a theology that explains away luck. It is pragmatic, results-based, and a therapeutic set of beliefs that explain why some believers rise to the top and others plummet to the very bottom. But it is not simply a theodicy, which is to say an explanation of evil. These new religious conceptions of the self constituting individual sprang up in part, as you know, as a response to late capitalism as a strategy for managing a new set of economic conditions. As countless histories of neoliberalism have documented, the privatization and reduction of social services characterized by this age has forced people to turn toward the market as a symbol of choice and solution-oriented thinking. But its solutions are also its burdens. A workforce promised flexibility is likely to much less likely to give employee benefits and stable hours. Risk and instability are woven into the fabric of the modern workplace. Prosperity believers know that the market is a fickle god, but they share its vision of the type of resourceful person who can persevere. The prosperity gospel, in explaining how to succeed, is very deliberate in showing believers how to account for their faith, how to tabulate their effort and the change in their lives. So if you ask, like, what are the economic differences when someone accepts the prosperity belief and after, the answer is absolutely nobody knows right now. And it really varies by class, and we can talk about how incredibly malleable it is by class. But what it does teach every single believer is a kind of calculus to tell if your life is working. How do I know that my faithfulness has borne results? They don't typically experience prosperity or the message as a random occurrence, a kind of mysterious envelope of cash in the mailbox or an unexplained healing, though many of them do report healings. But rather they learn a spiritual calculus that they use to weigh all of their actions as religious labor, from singing in church to smiling at their boss at work. So I'd argue that a lot of the theological effort of prosperity churches is directed at believers in cultivating a new religious imagination. This is the kind of how of the prosperity gospel, the patterns and tools that believers acquire to set their own beliefs in motion. It has popularized instruments by which to count change in an era of tremendous ambiguity about what constitutes paid work, and has successfully promoted a vision of the Christian life lived inside overlapping cosmic and American economies. Like Donald Trump's Think Big and Think Like a Champion, both of which I have audiobooks for, the economy of the American prosperity gospel is fueled by positivity and ambition and a steely resolve to stand alone if need be. It effectively explained away the role of chance, systemic obstacles, education, advantage, race, age, gender, generational wealth, and even skill in explaining why one worker thrived and another floundered. Their imagined workplace was governed by spiritual lessons and divine rewards, bosses who noticed, or companies launched if they didn't. Instead of a faceless system, believers saw an invisible God working on their behalf, who never imagined his children as just another cog in the machine. So in the past, I always thought that America didn't need a political prosperity gospel. Unlike Nigeria and Brazil and Guatemala, where iterations of the prosperity gospel have evolved into very hungry political parties, the prosperity gospel didn't seem to need a collective partisan platform, well-suited as it was to a nation where people still believed that with a little divine boost, they could make it on their own. But it appears that we are at the dawn of a new era of the political respectability of the prosperity gospel. Just as Nigeria's 1980s Pentecostalism evolved into a 1990s prosperity gospel in the wake of major privatization, it could be that the United States is simply adjusting its theological sails to new economic winds. It's never been directly tied to the market in an obvious way. So different iterations of the prosperity gospel that thrived in the 20s and 30s, it did as well in boom years as it did during the Depression. In times of wealth, right, it explains what people already have. In times of poverty, it offers them a free solution because thought is always free. But no matter what the market, it has always been yoked to the American conception of the self. The prosperity movement may not need a political party, but it has made a theological champion out of a New York businessman who has seemed impervious to risk and even failure itself. Every time Trump has fallen, he has gotten back up, somehow able to win in an unsteady world that wants to believe with him that there's no such thing as luck. Thanks so much.